The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
Look at that. We got the hang of it, you guys. That was like the best one yet.
Oh, man. It's hard.
Everyone has their microphone on. Everyone has their headphones on. Oh, yeah, Bill's got his on backwards.
I don't
Everything.
Oh, I do. Dang it. No, I don't.
You know, some things just, you know, I count on them.
No, I got mine on
He just likes them. He just likes them like that.
I like my left being my right being my left.
Exactly. So, of course, my computer needed
a contrary.
I can wash with dirt this time. Oh, my gosh. So, we're calling our guest here right now, and we'll be talking about his book. It's called Pharmaphobia, and it's not farm like...
Like afraid of doing farm work?
Yeah.
Afraid of the goats?
You're afraid of cows. No, pharmaphobia, how the conflict of interest myth undermines American medical innovation.
I got pharmaphobia and I left home. Hell with that garden.
That explains a lot.
It does.
Basically, Tom. His name is Tom Stossel. He is a medical doctor. So he has written this book. He contends that bureaucrats, reporters, politicians, and predatory laws have built careers attacking the medical products industry, belittling its critical contributions to medical innovation, and accusing it of non-existent malfeasance. Overselling product value, flaunting safety, and corrupting physicians and academics who partner with it.
Wow.
I know. It's quite a mouthful.
I might be guilty of that.
So, you know, it's funny because a lot of times that is the industry people like to point fingers at, and I don't know where that started, but we're going to find out. He's a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's a hematologist and a medical researcher at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Where he is the American Cancer Society Professor of Medicine. So, he's going to talk about all the medical stuff, and we're just going to listen.
Is he John Stossel's brother, though? That's what I wanted to know.
Somebody would say, he knew somebody would say that.
I'm sorry. I might as well get it out of the way.
Dr. Stossel, would you like me to pummel Bill for you, or do you want to just come over and do it yourself? it always starts out like that, doesn't it? So we only have an hour with you, and this sounds like a massive topic. And I've listed on our webpage, wethepeopleradio.us, for people that are, you know, not on there already. Just go to the webpage afterward, and you have links to the book and all sorts of things like that. But that being said, give us some input on this, because I read your whole thing, and I thought, geez, I guess I kind of knew this was happening. But it sounds like the consequences are bad for all of us.
Well, indeed. Aaron, first of all, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
So I really appreciate it. First of all, people need to understand that the book, it's Pharmaphobia, spelled with a P-H,
yes.
Not F.
Yes, no, not cows and pigs. We aren't afraid of them.
Right. And I wrote it for two reasons. One was just to get some facts across, so I'll just rattle them off. So, fact one, I'm old. I've been in medicine a long time, almost 50 years. And you hear nothing but whining about health care, the expense, and underinsured, and this and that. But the fact is, it's immensely better than when I started out. And just for example, we live on average 10 years longer. We're 60% less likely to die of a heart attack or stroke. And you just don't see people crippled up with arthritis the way it was when my career began. Now, fact, the reason things are so much better is because of the amazing tools we have to provide patients. And fact, those tools, medical devices and drugs, come dominantly from the private medical products industry, pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies. Fact, those innovations come to us with great difficulty and at great expense. And I'll put some numbers on that in a little while. Okay, so those are facts. And, you know, I find that intelligent, well-educated people, even physicians, don't know those facts. They're not taught in medical school how innovation works. And I didn't even know those facts in the early part of my career. I was in my academic bubble, and it was only when I had some experience with industry that I came to realize that I had been so clueless. So I wrote the book that people can understand. We get great value from industry, and it's really, really hard and expensive. Now, the second reason I wrote the book is because folks I call pharmaphobes came out of the woodwork 30 years ago when I was having my education with industry and deny these facts. They deny it. Oh, no, industry doesn't innovate. It's just profiteers. And it's corrupt. The industry is corrupt, and if physicians or researchers work with it and get paid to do so, they're corrupt. And the code name for this corruption is conflict of interest. Mm. Now, from that came a long laundry list of supposedly specific examples of corruption, and this led to an equally long laundry list of regulations that are now in place that I argue in the book slow down innovation. And so the book, what it does is it systematically goes through these myths, it explains them, and it blows them up.
Nice. So where did it all start? Was there kind of a beginning?
I think it all started when they started eating kale.
And started with what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Bill wants to blame it on kale.
Kale and Brussels sprouts.
Bill's a kale hater.
Okay. well, maybe, but so the pharmaphobes, to define them, come in different flavors. There are two basic classes. One is what I call instigators, and the instigators are academics who've discovered they can make a living beating up on industry. They get academic promotion, they get touted as experts, and so that's one instigator. Another is, with all due respect, and of course is the media. And of course I love the media, my brother and my son is editor of a magazine, and but you know, corruption, whether it's real or not,
sure,
sells copy. And so the media has been a major instigator. The biggest instigators, though, are the lawyers. The lawyers win if they sue you, if they prosecute you, or they defend you. And the more regulations that we have, the happier they are, because you have to pay them to teach you how to comply with those regulations.
And they get paid.
So those are
first.
The instigators. Now, the other promoters of pharmaphobia are what I call enabler enforcers. These are the people who run our health centers, particularly academic health centers. And they'll talk the talk about, oh, we need innovation, but it must be done with integrity, with transparency. And as soon as you start that kind of language, especially, we must avoid the appearance of conflict of interest,
sure,
schools out, because the instigators can come in and make anything look bad. And so the enforcer enablers are the ones who've actually made the rules. Because, as I said before, they talk the talk about innovation. What they really care about is avoiding scandal, not losing their high-paid jobs. And that's been the driving force that's gotten us these rules.
You know, and you see this with, we see this a lot in the West with environmental policy. Same kind of deal. If all the money is going to these academic centers and it's there to prove the government agenda of the, you know, of the anti-environmental people. Well, they're supposed to be the environmentalists, but really all they are is the anti-private property people. And somewhere that's where all of our science comes from. And when a regular guy speaks out, boom, he loses his tenure at, lost his tenure at UCLA. I'm sure there are many others. So it's the same basic problem.
Yeah, how do you argue?
Yeah, and
with,
you know,
the
key word, you use the word agenda, key, because the thing about this conflict of interest mythology is it's riddled with all kinds of highfalutin ethical baggage. It's about professionalism. Well, it's about money. So let's another sort of academic instigator class that I didn't mention are the people who manage medical journals. Now, I'm their worst enemy because I have cluttered up the I do medical research, as you said. I have cluttered up journals with all kinds of articles. And so I know that system very well. And it's very important for the advance of science. It's how scientists talk to each other. It's how they get credit for what they've done. But it has very little to do with medical innovation. So it's important to get across that the best game in town for evaluating the quality of safety and effectiveness of products is the FDA. You know, and here's I part company with my libertarian brother who would just as soon get rid of the FDA because I think the FDA actually does, for all the problems it has, a pretty good job. It has a terribly difficult job because, you know, if you approve a drug or a device and people's ears fall off, your head rolls.
Yeah.
If you don't approve it and we don't get a good product, nobody knows. And yet, it consistently does approve products, and that's how we get those tools and the advances I talked about in the beginning.
And so this
would be an opportunity to sort of lay those numbers down. So it now, on average, takes 16 years and costs $2.6 billion to get a drug approved by the FDA.
Jeez.
That's 100 times more expensive than when I started out in medicine. Now, some of that expense is because the FDA regulation has gotten more stringent, but nowhere near 100 times more stringent. But it's a little bit of stringency has a disproportionate effect because it impacts on a nasty fact, which is that biology is a bitch. So you think, why? You know, we
it
can make planes that fly by themselves and have great high-definition TVs that work great. Why is it so hard to develop a drug or a device? Well, it's because we design those planes or TVs, and we design them to be totally, we can make them totally predictable. We human beings are unpredictable, which actually is a good thing, because bacteria that dominate our world are coming after us all the time, and they can change, mutate every 20 minutes. We can't possibly keep up with that. So if we were predictable, totally predictable, they'd have wiped us out thousands of years ago. So the good news is we're having this conversation because we're unpredictable. The bad news is you put a drug or a device that looked great in the laboratory, looked great in test tubes, worked in animals, you get into clinical trials and 9 out of 10 fail. So the one success has to pay for those 9 failures.
Mm.
I don't know any way to make that easier, guys, but we shouldn't make it harder.
Yeah.
And
well, it's not benefiting anybody.
These regulations that have come into play that separate doctors and researchers from the industry, that keep industry representatives from talking to doctors about products, and then stupid trivial stuff like the drug rep can't leave a cup of coffee or a bagel to when she talks to the doctor, on and on and on and on. That slows it down, and that's a bad thing. So that's sort of a long-winded digression from the medical journals.
No, that's
come
okay.
Come back to that.
Okay, hold that thought. The managers of the medical journals deny that they
don't want you to know that the FDA is the best game in town. They want to take credit for it because they're selling information. So, once again, it's an agenda. It's about making money. And the medical journals have been in the forefront of selling the pharmaphobe message.
I can only imagine. All right, we're going to come back with Dr. Stossel in just a flash. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Body and soul, then it's just your body. give such delight.
Oh, we're going to hear the whole song. Hey, you're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We are here with Dr. Tom Stossel. We're talking about his book, Pharmaphobia, and this is the PH Pharmaphobia. The subtitle is How the Conflict of Interest Myth Undermines American Medical Innovation. And so, Dr. Stossel, talk to us about this, you know, the type of regulations that have been adopted because of the, because everybody believes that there's this conflict of interest thing.
Right. Well, the first set of regulations that came in with it focused on research, and it was based, they were based on the theory that if you took, if you were paid by companies, you would lie and cheat to appreciate stock. And the effect was that universities established sort of nanny pharmaphobe committees that would look over researchers' shoulders and would decide what research they could do, what rewards they could get, and in many cases they decreased rewards and told researchers that they couldn't do certain kinds of research. And in the 30 years that those rules have been on the books, there hadn't been a single case of lying or cheating for that reason. So we were talking about the academics. Occasionally you hear about scientific fraud, research fraud. It happens. It's heinous. It should be punished. But 95%+ of papers that are retracted, published papers that get retracted because of fraud, are published in medical journals and have no commercial connection whatsoever.
Hmm.
And it makes perfect sense because the FDA will never approve a product that's based on fraudulent data. And so the oversight is so much more stringent on the commercial side than it is on the academic side. So the theory is wrong, and those rules just get in the way of constructive research. So that was the first set. And then what sort of came in were the things I referred to before. They're based on the theory that marketing, that industry's marketing to physicians is corrupt. Well, guess what? Once again, the marketer, the drug rep, the device rep can only say what the FDA has approved. And I've hammered away that the FDA's information is the best game in town, as opposed to, you know, your local hospital advertises it has the best doctors. What's the evidence for that? I hope it does, but there's no regulation of that whatsoever. So increasingly, practices, first it was in academic centers, but non-academic health systems, they ban reps. Reps can't come and talk to the doctor. Well, stuff's changing all the time, and you want your doctor to be up to date. You want your doctor having access to as much information as possible. So say that your doctor can't talk to a company rep who is providing FDA-approved information about which the company knows more about than anybody. That's bad. That's potentially bad. But that's where we're going. That's where we've gone. Samples, which used to be given to patients, can't do samples because it promotes the use of expensive brand products. Well, you know, you come in your doctor's office and you got sky-high blood pressure. It would sure be a good thing if the doctor had some samples to give you and get your blood pressure down. Or your dermatologist gives you some goo and puts on your itch, and you say, hey, that feels good. Now you're more likely to go and fulfill the prescription. And we have a terrible problem with non-compliance with prescriptions. Anyway, I could go on and on about that. But let me give you a couple of examples of regulations that have come from this pharmaphobe mentality that are really bad. So one is a 2.3% tax on medical devices that is part of the Affordable Care Act. Now, the reason that tax got slapped on is because Congress bought the pharmaphobe argument, the denial of those numbers I gave you. Oh, it's not that expensive and difficult. They're exaggerating. Tax them. Well, the big guys, the big companies, they can afford to pay the tax. But the problem is that the cutting edge of innovation is occurring in small companies running on fumes. And those guys can only get their products to you if they can have an exit through the big companies. And if the big companies are frittering their assets away, paying taxes, that's less likely to happen. And those small companies then have no choice but to turn their lights out. So another incredible example of a regulation that's been fueled by this, pharmaphobia, is something called the Sunshine Act. Have you heard of it?
No, but I think I have the idea. I mean, they, you have to make everything public?
Yeah, exactly. So, but get this. Any payment of as little as $10 from a company to a physician has to get reported to the federal government, and you can go on a website and look it up. Now, it's amazing that the shallow thinking, oh, how can we be against transparency? What's wrong with knowing this? Well, you got 15 minutes to spend with your doctor. You want to talk about your symptoms or who's paying the doctor? It's the last thing you want to know. What's your doctor's training? What's your doctor's track record? What's your doctor's bedside manner? You know, this is a distortion of common sense. And it's insulting. You know, $10. A doctor is going to be bribed by $10. That's ridiculous, and I can tell you where that comes from. But it's not just that it's insulting, but it's really, really expensive to do that reporting. It's very complicated. So keeping track of who's paying whom and reporting it is costing billions. That's money that ought to be going to medical research, product development, and medical education, but we're frittering it away on this transparency.
Sure, and we're also paying somebody to go sift through all that minutiae to what end? You know, how has that helped the patient?
Well, I mean, as I said, it's useless for patients. You can't interpret it.
Sure.
You know, if I do a clinical trial, and I do it through my hospital, and the clinical trial costs $1 million, that appears on my roster. I don't do clinical trials, so I don't have that problem. But it's, you know, how would you possibly interpret that kind of craziness? Now, I'll tell you who does take it. The only people who take advantage of this are the muckraker media and the pharmaphobes, who are constantly looking for corruption. They haven't found it in 30 years, but they're confident that with all of this minutia, they're going to find it. So there's an outlet, which you probably have heard of, called ProPublica.
Okay.
The media business can't afford investigative reporting anymore. So this outfit, I think it's based in Chicago. It feeds the outlets with stuff, and they've taken this on big time. So they go to these databases and they look up and they shame doctors and they make them look bad. But here's my favorite. A couple of years ago, they correlated doctors who were getting paid. They found that the doctors got paid by industry and had been reprimanded by their state boards of registration. So you can imagine how this got sold. You know, corrupted doctors on company or bad doctors, flawed doctors on company payrolls. That's what my local paper said.
Nice.
Parroted this stuff. Okay, so I actually debated one of these reporters on national TV. And he said, we found hundreds of doctors who were reprimanded. Hundreds. Well, actually, it was 250 out of 17,700. Now, you do that math.
Yeah.
And that's three times lower than the average rate of being reprimanded by your state board. So actually, being paid by industry is a pretty good test of integrity. Didn't say it. Now, unfortunately, on that program, I missed the opportunity to make that point. Instead, the reporter who was interviewing me on TV said, Dr. Stossel, I see you got $2,000 from Pfizer. What's that about? And I said, Well, it's because I'm good. I add value. If I wasn't, I'd be a reporter.
Ouch.
No, but of course I don't apply that to you guys.
Well, no, because we're volunteers and we just do this on Sunday. So
okay,
our thought was to bring ideas and information that you don't hear in the regular media to the airwaves, so people can actually learn stuff. So stories like yours usually get, how long are your interviews? Like 3 minutes, 5 minutes? They're usually probably
well, that's
pretty
interesting.
Pretty
you know, I've been talking to, you know, conservative stations. In fact, I'd say pretty much 100%. I'll tell you a story about the one exception that didn't happen. But so, what's really been interesting about I'm really enjoying this media work is that what has tended to happen is I'll have 15 minutes or 10 minutes, and as I'm doing my shtick here, I can sort of feel the wheels turning. That the that the host, who usually is pretty clueless, not like you guys.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe this is interesting. Gee, maybe this is important. So a number of these, in fact, I'd say maybe 15% have been extended to 30 minutes, 45 minutes. And so I talked to my brother, who's done thousands and thousands of these things, and he says it's never happened to him. And
really?
The only explanation I can think of is it is so off the beaten track. And maybe it's because it's about your health that people kind of get it, maybe we ought to have this information. Anyway, that's been the experience.
Well, that's good.
No, I'll tell you about the one. So we have a local station, an NPR station, and I was asked to be on it, but the format it takes is that they bring an adversary in. There's somebody who debates you.
Sure.
Which is fine. But they couldn't find anybody to debate who would debate me. So they canceled it.
So they wouldn't
so
let you get the information out.
Unless
they
could. Censorship, in a way.
Sure. They had to find you a foil. Well, we see this all the time. I don't know if people realize this or not, but I think most sensible people who realize that, CO2 makes plants grow, they realize that all these IPCC scientists, when you start doing the numbers and looking at who's who, it's not the majority of scientists. It's just the majority of the ones that are paid by the big universities and that fund the agenda. Those are the guys you hear from. The other guys that are out there trying desperately to get the word out, and so now they've applied that logic to the pharmaceutical and medical device industry. Interesting. So we can all pay more, which is what it always necks down to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is the galling, the sort of arrogance. There's a lot of disrespect in what I'm dealing with. You know, it's the idea that doctors are bribed by $10. It's really disrespectful.
Yeah, no kidding.
The arrogance is it's not my, you know, if we go back to the global warming, it's not going to be my trillions of dollars that's spent to do what, you know,
yeah,
to do whatever we're going to do to solve a problem that may never happen.
Yeah, that they can't really prove. But if they don't keep everybody inside the corral, they can't keep the narrative alive. And some of this is the same way. And I think people have gotten comfortable bashing industry. And I think it's very good that you're putting it out there that actually costs you. We need to take one more quick, we've got actually two more quick breaks, but this is one of those. We won't take them all at the same time. We'll be right back. We're speaking with Dr. Tom Stossel, who is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research here at We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
After my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying, now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must tell me if you can. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what is wrong, 'cause I am wise to leave them open for so long.
There's a lot of doctors that tell me that I better start slowing it down. But there's more old rocks than they are old doctors, so I guess we better have another round. Well, now I gotta get drunk, and I sure do.
Well, there you go. Another regulated industry. You're joining We the People Radio. We're here with Dr. Tom Stossel discussing his book, Pharmaphobia. It describes how an ideological crusade stretching over the last quarter century has used distortion and flawed logic to make medical innovation even harder in the misguided pursuit of theoretical professional purity. I think that... So when people go to get a hip replacement or, you know, that kind of stuff, we hear a lot about this medical device tax. Those of us that haven't ever... you know, done that or aren't old enough or whatever, or didn't break in the right spots. How is that? I know you said there's a 2.3% tax because of Obamacare, but what are they doing to innovation with all this?
Well, as I said before, we discussed how difficult and expensive it is to get innovation. And the, you know, some years ago, Procter & Gamble, you know, used to make drugs. They stopped. They said it's too risky, so they only do consumer products.
Yeah.
There comes a tipping point where we've talked about 9 out of 10 projects fail, and the one success has to pay for the nine failures.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, hey, you know, I got stockholders. I got to keep this kind of lights on here. We're gonna stop making drugs and devices. We're gonna make dog food because it's a lot less risky. And so that's the problem. That's the frittering away of this tax. And as I said before, it's the denial of the difficulty and expense that is how that tax got put on in the first place. The equivalent for drugs, it hasn't become overt, but there's a lot of pressure, and a lot of doctors are clamoring for price controls. So, if you think about this, that we are the only country that doesn't control the prices of drugs. There are sort of under the table rationing schemes that the states allow pharmacists to substitute generics for brands, and there's lots of negotiation behind the scenes. But the fact is that the main profits that the companies make that they need to keep innovating come from sales in the United States. So, what happens is the other countries, which have these single payer government systems, control the prices. They make, say, you want to sell your product in Germany, you're going to have to sell it at a lower price. And for the companies, it's a no brainer. Don't sell it at all, or sell it at a discounted price. So that's what they do. And the result of all that is the entire world is freeloading off of American medical innovation. Now, there's probably nothing we can do about that, but the call here is that we need to rein in these prices. Now, medical product spending is about 13% of the trillions that are spent in healthcare in general. So most of the spending goes to hospitals and to doctors. And, of course, everybody's trying to point the finger at everybody else, you know, to blame them for high costs. And I say in the book, the companies have done a very poor job of explaining why they need to be profitable and defending themselves. And so as a result, they take the brunt of the hit. And, of course, the way it works out in practice is you go to your doctor. The doctor sees you, prescribes something. Your insurance pays for the doctor visit. Now you go to the pharmacy and you go to fill the prescription, and oh my God, I have this huge copay,
mm-hmm.
especially for some new drugs, some of which you may have heard of this new drug that cures the liver disease, hepatitis C. It's extremely expensive. And so in a big sticker shock, everybody's upset. You complain to the doctor, and the doctor, who doesn't really understand the economics of innovation, says, oh, these companies should be lowering their prices. We should have price controls. Now, well, you know, while I think while the Republicans control Congress, it ain't going to happen, but, you know, that sort of situation may not last forever. And if these bad ideas that still have innovation if we control prices, that we may end up going there. Another way this gets played out is, the reason these companies, of course, they could keep innovating is because they spend all this money on marketing. Well, they have to market. A product, no matter how great it is, if the doctor doesn't know about it, she won't prescribe it. If she does not know how to use it properly, it may hurt the patient. So the marketing is important. It's an integral part of the value chain. And if the companies stop marketing and their sales go down, then for sure they're going to stop innovating.
Is some of that
the reasons that we discussed before?
Well, is some of that the reason that they're marketing directly to the public? You know, that we have to sit through, hours of, I just can't believe they put some of these things on television with the side effects they have to actually say.
Well, that's the FDA. See that?
Yeah, who's doing that?
It is kind of crazy, and they spend a lot on it, which of course that the pharmaphobes then say that's. Shows that this is making them profitable, and we really don't have a great idea about what it actually brings in. But I can see that people's tastes are offended when there are Viagra ads at the Super Bowl and that sort of thing. But the fact is that this direct-to-consumer advertising often deals with stigmatized conditions.
Mm.
And so if it brings to the attention of the patient, gee, maybe I can get something for this, they go to see the doctor. And let's just take erectile dysfunction, the Viagra thing, that can be caused by diabetes, it can be caused by high blood pressure, and if a direct-to-consumer ad gets you in your doctor's office, and the doctor checks your blood pressure and checks your blood sugar and then treats you for those conditions, you're better off. So I think on balance, it has value. The quality is something else again. I mean the rattling off the side effects.
I know that's just
I don't get
a rule,
that because that should be the doctor's role, not the TV's.
Yeah, and some of it you think, gosh, that would have been better as a print ad with some really small print at the bottom.
Well, nobody reads the print ad either.
Well, that's the point.
The fact that if you really were couldn't have all those horrible side effects, you'd never want to take the drug. So,
I've got a question for you. Talk to us a little bit about the kind of the rift between the pharmaceutical companies and the homeopathic industry with vitamins and minerals. I mean, you hear a lot about that. These folks that are pushing the vitamins and the minerals, and if you take that, you don't need all these pharmaceutical drugs,
and those are unregulated.
Right. Well, so tell your listeners that after they buy and read my book, Pharmaphobia, they should read a book by a colleague who's a good guy named Paul Offit, Offitt. He is a pediatrician and a vaccine specialist in Philadelphia, and he wrote a book called "Do You Believe in Magic?" And he talks about your question, the question that you raised. And what I was fascinated to see is that he's very hard on they're called nutraceuticals,
right.
The supplements,
sure.
And all that stuff, and they're the way it works. Is there if the FDA determines that they are and the lingo is generally recognized as safe GRAS, then it's open season. Companies can market it, but they have to say that that this has not been approved, and but it gets a little hokey because they'll say clinical studies have shown, and those clinical studies
really
are
common.
Anything like what the FDA forces the drug and device companies to do. I would say but what I learned was that one reason that this industry is so gets such an easy ride is because celebrities have bought into it. And celebrities are politically powerful.
Hmm.
And so that has been a big force in keeping these things from being heavily regulated. Now, he's very down on them. I think he's offended by the intellectual dishonesty. I'm cutting him a little more slack because I think on balance, this is really a stretch, but it's one of the great things about this country is we're so affluent that we can afford to buy stuff that just doesn't work. but we can believe it works.
Well, you know, I brought that up with my doctor here, it was probably a month ago. We got to talking about the vitamins and minerals versus the drugs, and he actually got a little bit defensive, and I don't blame him, but he said, I'll tell you what, he goes, go ahead and just quit taking everything I've prescribed for you, and go ahead and get on all the minerals and vitamins and everything, and you come and see me in a couple of months, and we'll see if we can get you back on track again, because it doesn't work. It's all a bunch of smoke and mirrors. It may not hurt you, but it's not going to do what these pharmaceutical drugs do.
Well, this is fun, too, because I just looked up his book, Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine, and he has like a black hat with a bunch of stuff flying out of it, like a magician's hat. So we'll have to have him on.
He
looks fun.
It's a good read, and it's an important thing. You know, I think that I would try not to be defensive, but I think that, you know, as I say, it's a free country. People can do what they want.
Yeah.
There probably are times when people go after these things when they should be on real drugs. That's not good. And there have been some very high-profile cases of that. Occasionally these things are contaminated and hurt people. But, you know, and what actually is I find most amazing, and actually this is something we can talk about, is the FDA is very stringent about what companies can say about drugs. You know, like all that gibberish about side effects. Yet, these nutraceuticals can say anything, pretty much anything that they want. And that advertising is solely going to patients, to lay people who have no training and background. Whereas the highly regulated FDA information, the drug information, is going to doctors who are trained.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the FDA is much tougher on the companies about what they can say than they are about these nutraceutical things.
Pretty darn interesting. I think we should have him on here.
Notice to somebody, see the media reports of these huge fines that drug companies have paid. You know about that?
No, but hold on. Let's take a really fast break, and then we'll come right back and go to the top of the hour with that one, because that sounds interesting. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I'll tell you about the magic and the free your soul, but it's like trying to tell a stranger about a rock and roll. Believe in magic, don't bother to choose if it's jug-band music or rhythm and blues. Just go and listen, it'll start with a smile that won't wipe off your face, no matter how hard you try.
Better make some correction in all this infection. Just send in $1.98. Get rid of that running nose, that nagging cough, that sneeze, that wheeze. Other than your knees, take the wonder drug that cures all your ills. Take Jeremiah B. by his polyunsaturated, quick as all the gas, that can pleasant tasting green and purple peel.
Nice. I'm sure that's in... Sure, that's in the book about Do You Believe in Magic? At least we have the theme song all picked out for that show. Oh my gosh, we're here with Dr. Tom Stossel. We're discussing his book, Pharmaphobia, not the one with the cows and the pigs, but the one with the drugs and the medical devices. And bottom line is, our paranoia about conflict of interest is actually costing us not only money, but innovation, which obviously is stupid. So anyway, we should be we should require people to make more sense than that. That's just silly. And we have somebody on the phone who had a question here in our last few minutes, so we better hurry and do that, or they won't get to ask. Fire away. Hello.
Roberta. Hello.
Hi. You did not come on right away.
Well, so we're sorry about that.
You were there from my side.
No worries. What's your question?
Okay, I don't have a question. I have a comment.
Fire away.
I disagree with some of the things being said. However, the main thing I disagree with is he mentioned that supplement companies can say anything they want. That is not true. When they say when they make claims, it is illegal, and they can be brought up on charges. And so companies that are making claims are doing it at risk. So
okay.
I wanted to correct that. You cannot tell your neighbor that chicken soup helps the cold without a risk of being brought up as practicing medicine without a legal license.
Okay, we have like 2 minutes left, so let's let him answer here.
All righty, thanks.
Hey, thanks for calling, Dr. Stolz.
I had a little trouble hearing, but I guess the gist is that overstated the reign that the nutraceutical people have, and it's true there are limits to what they can say, and that's absolutely correct. But what I was, and I'll try to do it very quickly, is that the I think the real point is that the control of what the drug companies can say is much more stringent. And so a doctor can only prescribe a drug that's been approved for something, but the doctor can prescribe it once it's approved for anything else. That's called off-label prescribing. The companies, on the other hand, can only promote their drugs for what has been approved. And so if you can imagine that there were some gray areas, and in the past, companies would push the envelope a little bit, and the FDA would slap them down. But recently, a new occurrence has been that lawyers, prosecutors, gone after these companies under what is called false claims. False claims are billing the government for stuff you didn't do. And in this case, what the prosecutor has to prove is that, because it's the doctor that writes the prescription, it's the doctor that is billing the government, so that if the company's marketing caused the doctor to do the prescribing for an unapproved use.
Mm.
And that's a very hard case to make. You could probably never win a case like that because the doctors are trained and educated and so forth. But a lot of the conflict of interest, the paranoia, comes out in these indictments. But what ends up happening is the companies never defend themselves. They always settle and end up paying billions of dollars in fines. And the reason is the punishment for getting a conviction in this false claims legal strategy is something called debarment. I have never seen that word in a media report of these huge, when they talk about these huge fines. Debarment means your company cannot do any business with the federal government for any of its products. That means no products sold to Medicare, Medicaid, Veterans Administration. That's capital punishment. That's why these cases always settle.
Now that
and
figures.
There, the consequence is that billions of dollars, which is what these settlements are, once again, diverted from research, product development, and education to paying off these fines. And it's an extortion racket, plain and simple.
We love it. So we'll recommend people get the book, read it, learn stuff. We have been discussing this with Dr. Tom Stossel. Our time has run out here at the top of the hour. We so appreciate you being with us, and sounds like we might have to do it again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you. We'll be back with the second hour. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.